It is good to be back with you. If you cannot hear me, please make sure you raise your hand. On January 18th, 1915, 6 months into World War I, as all Europe lay convulsed by dying and killing, Virginia Woolf wrote in her journal, "The future is dark, which is, on the whole, the best thing the future can be." When she said dark, she seems to be saying mysterious or inscrutable, not terrible. How often, though, do we make the mistake? Do we mistake the mysterious for the terrible? How often do we, with television news on, consider ourselves to be at the end of all things, end of a civilization, end of an era? Darkness, gloom, global warming, ISIS, escalating terrorism. We want to transform the essential unknowability of the future into something very certain and most certainly dreadful. Are not these imagined futures in our heads nasty, brutish, and short? Scenario after scenario playing reruns in our heads where there is no way forward. I suggest that far stranger things have happened than the end of the world. Those of you alive in 1989, and I see most of you were, who imagined the end of the Soviet Union as you had known it all your lives? The fall of the Berlin Wall? Who dreamed that Nelson Mandela, after a prisoner for 27 years, becoming president of that most unlikely state, South Africa? Who would have thunk that in the summer of 2015, the Supreme Court of this land would make gay marriage a constitutional right? Can I get a witness? Let's face the obvious. We are not who we feared we would become. Forces are at work, I tell you, that say it is too early to go home. Giving up prematurely closes those accounts with reality. Listen to them. History is not some gross balance sheet of always obvious, dualistically opposed forces attacking and retreating each other. That's big screen Hollywood stuff. History is more the crab scuttling sideways or a drip, drip, drip of soft water wearing away the mountain. Or an earthquake breaking centuries of tension. Sometimes a few passionate people do change the world, but most often they are the first snowflake in the first moment of an avalanche that will involve trillions of other flakes. Anyone really alive looks for changes of their status quo. Just ask Martin Luther King Jr. Seeking a holy interruption to the status quo, he looked for changes with lenses ground in hope. I have a dream. To hope is to gamble, to bet on the future, to wager that an open and vulnerable heart is better than gloom and a gun. As he said, faith is taking the first step, even when you can't see the entire staircase. To hope is dangerous, but this danger we do not fear, for it is the risk of living as we are meant to live. Martin again, I have been to the mountaintop. I have seen the promised land, and I may not get there with you. This hope, though, is the core of who we are. Martin again, everything that gets done in this world is done by hope. Let's see what this risk is all about, because as Martin said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. First of all, hope means getting in the game, staying involved in life. There is no lottery ticket unless one rises from the easy chair to purchase one. And whether you purchase one will depend upon your family, whether it was a player. In this case, did your family feed on hope or dwell in gloom? I'll never forget Mrs. Mashburn in our church when I was growing up. A fine day, Mrs. Mashburn. A great day to be alive. Well, imitating Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh, but it's going to rain tomorrow. Getting involved in staying in the game means living a life of noticing this wild, precious, miraculous day. Turning off the news, turning down the volume of the background white noise, and noticing the first butterfly, the first hummingbird of the season. That's got to be news, right? Noticing the spaces between the music of Mark instead of the notes themselves. Seeing, and I'm going to get in trouble with this, seeing the Jehovah's Witness door knockers as the pioneers of First Amendment religious freedom that they are, instead of the interruption everyone says they are. Get with it. Stay involved. Start buying those lottery tickets, because hope is a verb with its sleeves ever rolled up. Second, what if the emergency that Fox and CNN breathlessly reports is there really isn't? When something happens so fast and becomes breaking news that takes us over, we can oftentimes just give up, give in, get all fearful, anxious, and we freeze. It's like we have this love affair with defeatism. When people find the end of the world easier to imagine than change. It's like the text my mom once sent me, and I am serious. Start worrying, details to follow. When waves come, we dwell more on their heights and their speeds, on how much damage they'll do rather than on how to surfboard them. One way to reimagine all this in the word emergency is the word emergence. What new thing is about to be born? One of my favorite poets, Hafiz, the Sufi poet, wrote, "Fear is the cheapest room in the house. I'd like to see you in better conditions." You see, in the calculus of hope, we can see the emergence in the emergency. Third on my list, O candidates of hope, is incrementalism, gradualism. Like you, I was born in a world of walls and Jim Crow and profiling and hate crimes and domestic violence and homophobia and perennial national emergencies, to start a list. But now, while nowhere being perfect or even near it, we inhabit a world that was unimaginable a few decades ago. What happened? Only what did not make the news. People kept up their quiet reading of Thoreau and Emerson and Harper Lee and Shakespeare and Mary Oliver and the Constitution. They kept singing. They kept hope alive. They changed, and they still change our culture, creating grassroots from the bottom movements. Our culture is still powered by writers, with ideas remaining the most dangerous things around. Meters get moved slowly. As we sit in the shade today, it's only because someone planted a tree a long time ago. Hope that's quick and easy is spelled H-Y-P-E, hype. Hope is not a quick fix. History is not made by great men and women, but by average dreamers, meeting on common ground, turning dreams into deeds, joining together to make turning points, then watersheds, and finally points of no return. Any idea that has not come, whose time has not come, no matter how wonderful, is going nowhere. But when that idea falls seed-like into prepared and cultivated human soils, sequoias happen. But sequoias take centuries. But sequoias can grow in no other way. So too hope. Gandhi said correctly, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. These stages take time. Slavery, it took almost a century to end. But the abolitionist movement won, and then that fueled the women's rights movement, which survived to cross-fertilize the civil rights movement, which provided both vocabulary and toolbox for gay rights. Where will this train stop? Spreading seeds of hope is not a journey to the corner store, but a plunge into the unknown and uncertain. The future's always dark. But that's where hope begins, this long and winding road. Hope's not a destination, but the way, the Tao, the road. Fourth, hope and the faith to hope are mystical. There's no standard boilerplate blueprint for hope, just a preparation for it. It may be that our greatest task is but to gamble, to seek out a metaphorical plot of ground and scatter seeds, which rats may eat, or they might rot, or some developer will build a condo over them. But Thoreau and Emerson and Dickinson and Whitman and Woolf achieved their greatest impact, surprise, surprise, only decades after they died. They were seed-scattering gamblers of the first order. And while you cannot map a direct road from their lives to our times would not be the same without them. One day in Auschwitz, the writer Primo Levi recited a canto of Dante's Divine Comedy, and that poem reached out from 600 years of dormancy to roll back Levi's despair and dehumanization. And he lived to become one of the Holocaust's greatest writers. You see, every seed that we succeed in planting, every word we leave behind, no matter how uncertain the future to which we entrust it, it's a victory wrenched from the powers of blasé, I don't care, boredom. The light we make today, I trust, gives a young person a different path to take tomorrow. You and I are beneficiaries of untold millions, no, billions of light bearers in the past, whose stories we shall never, ever, ever know, but who have contributed to our rich lives because they sowed seeds of hope. You see, there's something stubborn about hope. It has little to do with that parts of us that think if we just diet right, or work out hard enough, or take the right vitamin cocktail, or contribute to the NPR, or eat our kale, then hope happens. Nope, no shortcuts. We need to filibuster the heavens. Let me repeat that. We need to filibuster the heavens. The problem is not that God forgets us. The problem is when we stop wanting hope and justice. Are we willing or not to get down and dirty long enough to be transformed by that hope aborning in us? Long enough then to release that newborn into the world? We have to want it. Even if the universe as we know it laughs in scorn, we must stubbornly wrestle today's hope into existence like our ancestors wrestled equality and peace and freedom into reality. You see, hope is the muscle of the imagination, not to be any more neglected than our heart muscle is to be exercised and put through its paces every day. The world will give us crap. The world will give us many reasons to doubt, many reasons to be certain that hope is no more than whistling through the graveyard. That to hope is somehow to deny the blunt force instrument of reality. I'm here to declare otherwise. My wife, who is preaching at this very moment up in Hendersonville, once worked with Palestinians in the West Bank. She told me once of this illegal Palestinian settler squatting on to him what was illegal ground, but who nevertheless spent his days planting and tending fig trees, all of which could have been plowed under any day, or if they survived, would not produce a crop for 5 to 7 years. Just give that a moment. Hope is the thing with feathers, wrote Emily Dickinson. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul, that sings the tunes without words, and never stops at all. Author E.B. White wrote books that are still bestsellers, like Elements of Style, Stuart Little, Charlotte's Web. He wrote hundreds of letters. In March of 1973, he wrote the following perfectly formed letter to a Mr. Nadeau, who sought White's opinion on what he saw as a bleak future for the human race. My dear Mr. Nadeau, as long as there is one upright man, as long as there is one compassionate woman, the contagion may spread, and the scene is not desolate. Hope is the thing that's left to us in a bad time. I shall get up on Sunday morning and wind the clock as a contribution to order and steadfastness. Sailors have an expression about the weather. They say the weather is a great bluffer. I guess the same is true of our human society. Things can look dark. Then a break shows in the clouds, and all is changed, sometimes rather suddenly. It's quite obvious that the human race has made a queer mess of this life on this planet, but as a people, we probably harbor seeds of goodness that have lain a long time, waiting to sprout when the conditions are right. Our curiosity, our relentlessness, our inventiveness, our ingenuity have led us into deep, deep trouble. We can only hope that these same traits will enable us to claw our way out. So, Mr. Nadeau, hang on to your hat, hang on to your hope, and wind the clock, for tomorrow is another day. Sincerely, E.B. White. We can lose our hat. We can easily get discouraged, despair, see no reason to wind the clock, and there will be bottom finger feeders who want to drag us down to their levels. I don't know your stories that well, or the pain, or all the setbacks. But I do know that we have some pretty irresistible forces to manage, and they have names, like your CEO, or your university president, or your boss, or a political candidate, perhaps a relative, who keeps on tearing you down, denying your humanity, your worth, your part, and your portion on this earth. What do you do with all the poo? One can stockpile it until it becomes a toxic mess, or you can turn it into fertilizer. All the crap they're handing out is just fertilizer. Exhibit A is something I brought today to show you. I've taken this cross to Cuba and around the Western North Carolina area to demonstrate the power of hope that transforms poo, can I say that word here? Poo into fertilizer. Wiley Dobbs is on death row in Georgia. He should be dead by now, except for his case's complications that slow down the death machinery there. What he does is take the blue and the white towels of the prison system and over the weeks and months pulls a few threads out so as not to make anybody suspicious, and these he knits. It takes quite a while to gather enough thread on the down low to knit across this size. But that, my friends, is visible hope. All the poo our systems give him is just fertilizer. He told me once, the state seeks to bury us, but what they don't know is that they're helping me plant seeds. One day you finally knew, wrote Mary Oliver, what you had to do. And you began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their foundations were, and though they were terrible, it was already late and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left these voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there's a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Final story. Back in 1986, before South Africa was free and President Nelson Mandela was prisoner Nelson, I heard Archbishop Desmond Tutu speak outside the South African embassy in Washington, D.C. His words were directed to those inside the embassy, and they went like this. I wish I had his accent. "You inside, do you hear me? You have lost already. Do you even understand what that means? You on the inside have already lost, and we on the outside have won. We all know how this struggle for freedom and liberation will turn out, for God is on the side of the oppressed. It's not we shall win. Oh no, we have already won. Only you just haven't realized it yet. We outsiders have, and we know the future. We are the future. Come on outside and meet your future." Impossible things take a little longer, but when fertilized with hope, they're possible. All I can do, all I'm called to do, is plant myself beside the gates of hope. Not the prudent gates of optimism, not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, nor the cheerful, flimsy garden of everything's going to be all right, but a different, lonely place, that place of truth-telling about your own soul and its condition, that place of resistance and defiance. Don't like the news? Keep winding your clock. Go out and make news of your own. Plant sequoias. Stay strong. Practice resurrection.